France says it has taken a series of initial measures in response to the recent anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Yemeni armed forces say they have successfully thwarted an attempt by a foreign ship to steal the country's oil at a southern port. Also ahead, Germany says it has reached an agreement to supply Poland with Patriot anti-aircraft systems following a deadly rocket strike close to the border with Ukraine. Our top story, Tehran says a series of initial measures have been taken in response to the recent anti-Iran resolution by the International Atomic Energy Agency. The foreign ministry spokesman says the details of the steps will be announced by the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Nasser Kanani says the West's support for the recent anti-Iran resolution by the IAEA showed their will to hinder technical cooperation between Tehran and the UN agency. According to Kanani, Western countries were expected to avoid such politically motivated measures, considering Iran's positive and constructive cooperation with the IAEA. The resolution adopted on Thursday calls on Tehran to fully cooperate with the agency's probe into uranium traces at three alleged undeclared sites in Iran. Tehran says the IAEA is basing its statements on information fabricated by Israel. During our news review program, we discussed Iran's missile and drone attacks on bases of Kurdish militants in northern Iraq.
Time now for the news review section. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it's carried out fresh drone and missile strikes against neighboring Iraq's northern Kurdistan region. The IRGC says that the strikes targeted the remaining positions of terrorists and separatist groups operating against Iran. The force says that the raids hit locations deep into the Kurdistan region and destroyed their targets. According to the IRGC, the attacks dealt a heavy blow to the terrorists. The force has carried out three rounds of such strikes in northern Iraq recently. Iran says that Iraq's federal government has a responsibility to prevent any threats coming from the Arab country's northern Kurdistan region. Now, allow me to invite a couple of guests to see what they think about this. So we have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London. Also with us is Faraz El Najem, manager with the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights in Toronto. Now, Mohsen Abbas, this is the umpteenth time I remember announcing here myself Iran giving warning to Iraq, both the central government and the Kurdistan region, against allowing Iraqi soil to turn into a hub for terrorist operations and for any threat or menace coming Iran's way from inside Iraqi soil. But unfortunately, no practical action. Promises have been made lots of times, but no practical action on the ground. And this is, I don't know how many times, but the IRIB has been doing this recently, and they say that they have to do it because they are entitled to provide and ensure security for Iran. Let's have your thoughts on this.
Well, it's getting increasingly crucial. It has, of course, been a long-running situation, this problem within the Kurdish region. And Iran, as you rightly say, has been trying to have it resolved to no avail, it seems. And now, as they say, the chickens are coming home to roost, because it's that very corridor of the Iraqi Kurdistan region where a lot of the weapons, a lot of the supplies, and a lot of the current insurgents as well within Iran are taking huge support through basically. And what's the background to this region's connections to the enemies of Iran? Well, that's really important, and I people often don't maybe cite this, but Israel has a huge presence in this northern Iraqi Kurdistani region, and they've had it for decades. 1931, was the earliest Israeli connection with the Kurds through Reuven Shiloah, who was the future Mossad director, who actually laid the grounds for most of the alliances they have in that region. The 1950s saw the Israelis come up with the periphery doctrine, which meant Israel would make friends with all of the non-Arab peoples around or surrounding the Arabs, and the Odin-Yinon plan in 1982 consolidated this. Kurdish-Israeli relations are very warm economically as well as militarily. It's been time and time, Seymour Hersh, for instance, was one journalist who exposed that the Israelis were training Kurds on the ground, and there are known to be Israeli corporate companies working on, for instance, Erbil Airport and other signs of Israeli interference within that region. All of this means basically Israel has been not only destabilizing Iraq through these Kurdish forces, who they've been encouraging with the temptation of a Kurdish state in the not-too-distant future, and they're also destabilizing Iran, and as you can see, Turkey and Syria are also affected. But they're playing a lot of the Turkish groups off each other as well, and using different ones for different operations. And the ones that are dealing with Iran, well, the IRGC has gone after them yet again this week, and with a warning. In the long run, could it be that Iran needs to carry out an actual on-the-ground military operation to clear out those Israeli-backed Kurds who are basically creating insurgencies and huge insurrectionist problems for Iran as well now, as well as Iraq?
Okay. Now, Francois Nejem, how do you look at this issue? From what angle? And who do you think is sponsoring all those terrorist operations that are happening from inside Iraqi SWAT in the Kurdistan region? Because, you know, Iran and Iraq have good and brotherly ties, but this is happening.
Yes, it's clear if you look at the history of Mas'ud Barzani, the one leading the north of Iraq, so-called Kurdistan region. He's had a lot of relations with Saddam in the earlier stage, and he's very friendly with the Americans, and also it's well known that he's very friendly with the Israelis, and there's a lot of Israeli companies and organizations working inside the north of Iraq. And the Iraqi government has spoke against this many times, and certain MPs have spoken against this and threatened also military action. And at a certain point also, he tried to cause sedition by separating the north of Iraq from Iraq, and he did a referendum. It was like a plot. It was kind of like a scheme that he wanted to do really quick, and he failed miserably at that time because the Iraqi army and the popular mobilization forces, mobilized really quick and stopped this type of sedition and type of division in the Middle East, West Asia, as Sayyid Khamenei calls it. So, the north of Iraq, it's a project that's trying to prop up and spread this project all over the different countries such as Iran and Turkey. They want to separate Kurdish areas where they're predominantly Kurdish there, and they're inflaming and also empowering them by the West. Like they're supporting these separatists and these people that are terrorist organizations such as PKK and different organizations. And that's why Turkey continuously hits them. That's why Iran continuously hits them. And Iraq is always under threat because of their, evil acts and so on. And hopefully this evil project of building this, Kurdistan region and separating from the whole, from each country will be dismantled, hopefully. And the IRGC are doing a great job at fighting terrorism, inside Iran right now, terrorist groups that are empowered by the West and also empowered by the north of Iraq based there through the system inside the north of Iraq. At the same time, they fought fiercely against the terrorists in Syria, and they also helped and secured Iraq by fighting ISIS. So, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps are really an anti-terrorist organization and force. Unfortunately, the West paints them as their terrorist organization. It's the total opposite. And, this is just a manipulation and a fabrication for an evil agenda of the West to dominate and divide and conquer the whole region. But right. The IRGC force is very, very powerful, and hopefully they will deal with the situation.
Okay. Thank you so much for that, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas in London, Faraz al-Najm in Toronto with our comments and contribution.
Turning elsewhere now, along with other hardships, the poor in Afghanistan have difficulty providing winter fuel to warm their shelters. A number of them have received wood and coal from the Iranian embassy in Kabul. Abdullah Mirzadeh reports from the Afghan capital.
People have gathered to receive winter fuel in form of coal and wood distributed by Iranian embassy in Kabul to warm the cold days of their lives. Najiba and Tahira, who take care of their children all alone, cry out the problems of the cold winter.
I don't have a supporter and my husband has passed away. It's five of us in my family, all of whom are jobless. Currently, we live in a rental house. We could really use such aids and hope it continues, especially in winters.
It is a hard winter, especially for us who don't have the primary needs of our lives. I have small children. I literally don't have anything to warm my home. I work hard to feed my seven family members, but still can't meet our needs.
Almost all who receive relief aids are widows and orphans, most of whom burn plastic, tires, and other waste materials to warm their houses and sometimes cook food. The happiness is noticeable as these widows can provide a warm home for their orphans. The number of these families can reach up to 1,000.
Well, we are prepared to distribute fuel to 1,000 families. The fuel is firewood and coal. We give each family a package of almost 200 kilograms. It isn't much, but it could be enough for almost a month. We are hoping to be able to continue such activities in the coming months also.
With the arrival of winter, concerns about the situation of the people of Afghanistan have intensified. The arrival of winter and warming houses has added to the daily problems of the poor in Afghanistan. Although aid is being provided to some people, there are still many who spend their nights in cold weather. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Yemeni army says it has thwarted an attempt by an enemy tanker to plunder the country's oil in the south. In a series of tweets, the army's spokesman said the ship was on a mission to steal, quote, enormous amounts of oil from the port of Al-Dhaba. Yahya Sari added that Yemeni armed forces adequately dealt with the ship after it refused to heed warnings. He further vowed that the Yemeni armed forces would continue to protect the country's resources. In recent weeks, Yemen says it has foiled at least two other attempts by Saudi-led coalition to loot its oil. Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition looted more than $13 billion worth of the country's oil between 2016 and 2021. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. Germany says it has reached an agreement with Poland to help protect its skies following a recent deadly rocket strike close to the border with Ukraine. Germany's defense minister says it will send anti-aircraft systems to Poland and support in securing Polish airspace with Eurofighter jets. Before the deal, the Polish defense minister said he welcomed the German proposal with satisfaction. Two people were killed last week when a missile landed in a Polish village. Warsaw and NATO said the explosion was likely caused by a Ukrainian missile launched to intercept a Russian barrage, but stressed that Moscow was ultimately to blame since it started the conflict. The German minister has said she hopes NATO does not become a participant in this conflict. Negotiators from nearly 200 countries at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt took a historic step of agreeing to help climate victims They, however, failed to reach a consensus to curb on fossil fuels or greenhouse gas emissions, which are the main causes of global warming.
Negotiators from nearly 200 countries at the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt agreed to set up a loss and damage fund meant to help vulnerable countries cope with climate disasters. They also agreed the globe needs to cut greenhouse gas emissions nearly in half by 2030. The agreement also reaffirmed the goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. However, for the 27th time, the UN climate talks have failed to directly address the biggest driver of the climate crisis, the production of gas, oil, and coal. This is amid calls for the phase-out of all fossil fuels inside the conference walls and beyond. More than 80 countries had supported a proposal to phase down the use of fossil fuels at the UN Climate Summit. Ultimately, an attempt to address the biggest source of the planet warming emissions that are causing the climate crisis ended in a fiasco, as the participants only agreed to phase down polluting coal power and phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies. That's after a number of oil and gas producing nations, led by Saudi Arabia, blocked a key proposal to phase out all fossil fuels, not just coal. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said it is more than frustrating to see overdue steps on mitigation and the phase-out of fossil energies being stonewalled by a number of large emitters and oil producers. Addressing this summit, the European Union's climate chief, Frans Timmermans, said the EU was disappointed with the final outcome of the summit. Environmental campaigners labeled the COP27 summit as yet another monumental failure to tackle climate crisis. Activists blasted richer countries for not doing more to limit carbon emissions. They say the US, EU, UK, and others came to the summit with empty words, hollow promises, and the refusal to take responsibility for having set the planet on fire and destroying millions of lives and livelihoods.
That brings an end to the World Bulletin for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you. Early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
COP27 delegates in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, have agreed to establish a loss and damage fund that would compensate developing countries hit hardest by climate change. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. The world's poorest countries have scored a historic victory at the COP27 climate summit in Egypt after countries agreed to set up a fund to help poor countries being battered by climate disasters, but delayed approving a wider deal outlining global resolve to fight climate change. After tense negotiations that ran through the night, the Egyptian COP27 presidency early on Sunday released a draft text for an overall agreement and simultaneously called a plenary session to gavel it through as the final overarching agreement for the United Nations summit. The session approved a tax provision to set up a loss and damage fund to help developing countries bear the immediate costs of climate-fueled events such as storms and floods. But it kicked many of the most controversial decisions on the fund into next year, when a transitional committee would make recommendations for countries to then adopt at the COP28 climate summit in November of 2023. Developing countries have been asking for help with loss and damage, financial assistance to rescue and rebuild stricken countries after climate-related disasters for more than a decade. But rich countries have until now refused, providing limited cash instead to help them cut greenhouse gas emissions and build defenses against extreme weather. Spirits are high, said Jean Sou, Energy Justice Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Jean Sou added, climate vulnerable nations and civil society are beaming at a big step forward on creating a loss and damage fund, more than a decade in the making. Maisa Rojas, Chile's environment minister, called the fund a historic step. But a deal was still uncertain as the clock ticked on the extension of the COP27 United Nations Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, running well beyond delegates' Friday, 18th of November deadline. Mohamed Addo, director of energy and climate at the think tank PowerShift Africa, said, COP27 United Nations Climate Summit has done what no other COP summit has achieved, and created a loss and damage fund to support the most impacted communities of climate change. This has been something which vulnerable nations have been calling for since at least the 1992 Rio Earth Summit in Brazil. It was a day of high drama in Sharm el-Sheikh and bitter conflict between rich and poor nations. Some of the world's poorest countries denounced richer nations for delaying action and refusing financial assistance for afflicted countries for so long. The German broadcaster Deutsche Welle has also covered the same story. Climate negotiators agreed early on Sunday, 20th of November, to establish a fund to compensate developing and climate-vulnerable countries hit hardest by worsening weather extremes. After 2 weeks of fraught negotiations at the COP27 climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, negotiations were scheduled to end on Friday, 18th of November, but disagreements over key issues led to the conference going into overtime. Countries managed to strike a deal on the thorniest issue, compensating poor countries, those least responsible for climate change, for loss and damage caused by climate change. That came after the G77 group of developing nations, who have long called for industrialized nations to pay reparations for climate harm, had the issue added to the official COP agenda for the first time. Full details still have to be hammered out. The fund was not optimal, but it addressed developing nations' basic demand that major historical polluters, such as the United States of America and the European Union, help vulnerable countries pay for damage caused by climate change. This was tweeted by Pakistan's climate minister, Sheri Rahman, whose country was hit by massive deadly flooding in the summer of this year. The agreement on the compensation fund came after a draft final declaration was partially approved. However, an overall final agreement on other sticking points is still pending. Other major sticking points have included increased funding for developing and climate-vulnerable countries to adapt to a warming world, language around phasing out climate-warping fossil fuels, and an agreement to lock countries into increasing their ambitions to cut greenhouse gas emissions. The European Union threatened to walk away from the negotiations at one point in Sharm el-Sheikh, saying commitments on emission cuts lacked ambition and would fail to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, a target reaffirmed at the Glasgow summit last year. Current action has the world on track for up to 2.7 degrees Celsius warming, which would cause widespread drought, water scarcity, and flooding. The host country, Egypt, faced criticism for its chaotic approach to negotiations, with allegations from negotiating parties that they were not distributing key texts and key information, and even that they were not acting as an honest broker. The agreement on climate reparation payments represented a major U-turn in the talks after the European Union softened its position near the end of the summit. Big polluters had previously resisted a specific fund in fear of being liable for all climate-related extreme weather events. The European Union initially offered to establish a special fund that would cover particularly vulnerable nations in exchange for commitments on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and if China, now the world's biggest emitter, would pay into this fund. But the idea faced opposition from the Group of 77, the G77 Group of Developing Nations, a coalition of 134 developing countries, who wanted funding for all of its members, including fossil fuel producers and emitters, countries like India and Pakistan. And big polluters, such as the United States of America, were reticent to commit finance to such a fund. Negotiators at COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, have also clashed over the failure to mention a phase down of all fossil fuels in the agreement. India had insisted that the final text ask countries to phase down all fossil fuel use and not just coal. Brazil also committed to introducing a zero deforestation law for the Amazon rainforest in 2023, with the Democratic Republic of Congo and Indonesia also showing intent to follow suit.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is a bezel of wisdom from the gateway of the City of Knowledge, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Meet people in such a manner that if you die, they weep for you. And if you're alive, they long for your company.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, types of bad manner. In today's lesson, we will talk about the types of bad manners in Islam and which we need to avoid in our Islamic lifestyle. We know that there are the consequences that a person who has bad manner he has to face. And from the consequences, if I want to just count some of them, is that the person who has bad manner, it is said that he will go to the hellfire. He will face the hellfire. He will have the hard time in the grave. He will not have friends in this world. And obviously, he will be someone who does not get the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there are many other things. And that's why Quran is emphasizing on having a good manner. And what the things that we need to consider is that we should know what does come under the bad manner. Some of the things that we can just mention is, number one, is that if someone insists on the sin or doing evil or bad deeds, this is one of the bad manners. That Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who has created us, He wants us to not to perform bad deeds. He does not want us to perform evil deeds or to perform sin in our life. Therefore, someone who insists and keep repeating the bad deeds and he does that, this is from the bad manners. Number two is being ungrateful towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the people who help us, or maybe they have done a favor for us. Therefore, the one who is ungrateful to others is also known as being having the bad manners. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the types of bad manners in the Islam and which we need to avoid in the Islamic lifestyle. Therefore, we mentioned two of them, that the one who keeps perform the bad evils, and the second one was to be ungrateful. Now, the third thing that comes under the list of the bad manners, we can say like being arrogant, and this arrogance is something that brings the bad manner in our life, which makes us to be bad amongst the people. Number four is being suspicious towards other. The suspicion, or the being suspicious towards the other, always thinking bad about the people, and this also is something from the bad manners. And the next thing is being jealous of others. Why we should be jealous of others? We should be thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for what we have. Therefore, those who are jealous towards the others, remember that this is the sign of having the bad manner. The next thing which we can count is having a bad language, talking to people in a bad way. For example, some people have the habit of abusing others or using the non-ethical words or bad words against someone. So this is not good that to talk with them in that way. The next thing is to be a liar. If someone lies a lot, that is also amongst the bad manners. And after that, the thing which we can count is the one who swears wrongly. This is also from the bad manner. And on top of list, we can say that sometimes we see people who basically accuse people, who make scandals for the people, and it's a wrong thing. And after that, backbiting is one of the important things. And then we can look at the matter of someone who is basically teasing his neighbors. Teasing his neighbors is also something that is not good. And it's been known as, you know, from the bad manners. And after that, we know that there are some people who reproach, who look for the faults of the others. And this is also from the bad manners. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
They're back as India has released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The 8 radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India, covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. After repeated failed attempts, NASA has eventually launched this moon rocket on its debut flight. NASA's next-generation moon rocket blasted off from Florida, marking the start of the space agency's new program dubbed Artemis. An uncrewed Orion spaceship is fixed to the top of the 32-story tall Space Launch System rocket. It will be separated for a 25-day voyage around the moon and back without astronauts aboard. It was the third time after two previous launch attempts were cancelled for technical reasons. If the mission succeeds, a crewed Artemis II will orbit around the moon but not land on the surface in 2024. The third Artemis mission, scheduled for 2025, will be the first to put astronauts on the moon since Apollo's mission about 5 decades ago.
Iran has hosted an international student scientific contest dubbed Noor or Light. The annual event seeks to promote science among children and scout for child prodigies. Yusuf Jalali has the story.
They have only 1 minute to present a scientific idea in their homemade clips. Over 1,300 teenage science enthusiasts from 19 countries participated in Iran's Noor competition, a scientific contest for school students. The fifth edition of the event was themed with optical illusion and mathematical modeling. The top 100 videos were awarded during this closing ceremony in Tehran.
My work is titled The Bouncing Ball. We painted a long oval and a shadow under it. When we film it from a certain angle, it takes the shape of a levitating ball.
Our work is about an optical illusion.
We created a set of conjoining cylinders that appeared to change shape in the mirror. The idea was first created by a Japanese engineer in 2016.
The most creative videos win the prize. They should be both educational and mind-blowing, like this floating Rubik's Cube, which appears to be levitating, but then turns out to be just an origami work.
We have two levels of the competition. One is the kind of general competition for the crowd, and many students can contribute on that, in that. And we have other level, which is for elites. And in that level, we have more sophisticated competition between elite.
Organizers say participants in newer contests are not supposed to make breakthroughs. The main goal, they say, is to engage them in science and let them experience the excitement of scientific experiments.
Try to make these teenagers learn how they can think about science for the welfare of human beings and how they can apply it for them.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation is the organizer of this scientific event. The foundation also holds the biennial Mustafa Prize, which awards cash prizes to top scientists from across the Muslim world, whose accomplishments contribute to the welfare of human beings.
Mustafa Science and Technology Foundation, as the organizer of Noor Competition, says prodigies are everywhere. They just need to be discovered. It says this contest is a platform that's specially designed to scout for teenage minds and give them a chance to shine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Chinese aerobatic teams have been performing jaw-dropping stunts to mark the 73rd anniversary of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. Pilots wowed the audience with their complicated maneuvers, such as swooping close to the ground, making loops and rolls. Aerobatic teams use red, yellow and blue smoke trails representing the flag of the Chinese Air Force. The Hong Ying aerobatic team, also known as the Red Eagle, is made up of 10 JL-8 trainer planes and 20 pilots from the Air Force Aviation University. The performance was part of China's International Aviation and Aerospace Exhibition held in southern China. The exhibit typically draws thousands of participants in the field of aviation from countries all over the world. Iran is the land of saffron, and the red gold has earned the country a fortune throughout the centuries. Now Iran's city of Torbat Haydariya has hosted a saffron photography festival as a means to introduce the lucrative product to the world. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Like gold, it is weighed in shekels, not in kilos. And that's why saffron is called the red gold, reflecting how precious it is economically. Torbat Haydariya in northeast Iran is the hub of saffron cultivation in the country, producing an average of 20 million tons of the crop each year. Now the city hosts the Festival of Saffron Photography every year to introduce Iran as the land of saffron and how these hard-working farmers produce the strategic crop.
Photographers present in this festival should use their artistry to shed light on different stages of saffron harvest all the way to the final product. Everyone knows Iranian saffron, but perhaps few know how it's produced. So this festival highlights this issue using photography.
Photography is a universal language that needs no translation, so their photos can better introduce this strategic plan to the world from unique angles.
This year, Iran exported roughly 300 tons of saffron, generating more than $350 million in income, according to the data provided by the Ministry of Agriculture. Experts believe Iran could have a much higher share of the global trade of saffron if it pays better attention to branding and marketing of the product.
Due to favorable weather conditions, Iranian saffron is unique in the world. But unfortunately, in many countries, it's smuggled in bulk and is packaged under foreign brands and then sold at higher prices. If we can brand it inside Iran, Then we can export it more efficiently.
The young farm owner says his saffron is exported to Europe and the Middle East, despite the restrictions caused by U.S. sanctions on Iran. But more than the U.S. measures, he's concerned about the impact of climate change on saffron cultivation, warning of what he calls saffron immigration from his city, if authorities remain idle.
Unfortunately, saffron is gradually leaving our region and moving to western parts of Iran. This is due to changes in weather conditions and declining rainfall here. If the government helps farmers with modification of planting patterns, we can stop this disaster.
Over the past 2 years, Iran has expanded its cultivation area for saffron to 115,000 hectares, nearly 20 times more than the entire worldwide land dedicated to the crop. While the Iranian red gold is mainly cultivated in the northeastern Khorasan province, other parts of the country, including Khuzestan and Chaharmahal Bakhtiari, are also fertile for saffron farming.
For centuries, saffron has been a key word in Iran's economy, and still is today. Now, Saffron Photography Festival says many know Iran by its red gold, but through the photos shot here, they will get a glimpse of the mesmerizing saffron farms in Iran and how this amazing crop is produced. Yusuf Jalali from the saffron farms in the suburbs of Turbat Haydariye.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Usually, rats are associated with garbage and disease, but these rats are not the typical rodents. They are being trained in Tanzania for search and rescue operations. These are a breed called the African giant pouch rat, which is naturally a very curious creature. It can weigh up to around 1,500 grams and are known to have longer lifespans than other rats. Lead researcher at the Belgium-based non-profit company Apopo, Donna Keen, says this species can live up to 10 years. This means that even after the 9 months of training, the rat will still have a long working career ahead. The size and agility of rats make them invaluable for search and rescue efforts.
So this is where the idea for the rats came in, because the rats are just as trainable as dogs. They've got a great sense of smell, and their small size and natural agility should hopefully make them really good in this scenario where they could squeeze in small spaces and get closer to any victims.
The rescue rats began training in August last year at the Apopo's Training and Research Center. The rodents are fitted with tiny backpacks that enable real-time wireless audio-visual communication. When they find a potential victim, they pull a small handle hanging around their neck to let the rescue handlers know. The rats were trained to locate humans in mock disaster zones, such as aftermath of earthquakes. Apopo has already trained rats to detect landmines and sniff out tuberculosis. So much joy can be found in a bottle of luxury perfume, but parting with hundreds of dollars for such scents, I can take the shine off that experience. Now in Syria, a perfumer is helping people smell expensive without digging too deep into their pockets. One whiff of a fragrance is all a Syrian perfumer needs to recreate the scents of luxury brands for a fraction of a cost. That's very welcome in a country ravaged by years of foreign-backed militancy. Dozens of customers flock daily to his tiny store nestled in the historic bazaar of Damascus. They flash photos on their phones of high-end perfumes they want to replicate. He says all he has is his nose.
Here lies the secret of the profession and the brain power. I started training my nose to smell perfumes since I was 15 years old. I do not own high-end equipment. All I have is my nose, my brain power and expertise. That's all.
In the war-torn country, many people struggle to afford life's bare necessities, let alone perfume. With the local currency losing much of its value, Syrian employees reportedly make roughly $25 a month, on average a quarter of the price of a bottle of imported perfume. This perfumer sells his fragrances for about $6, drawing in a flow of clients from all walks of life. Some people believe the internet will soon make paper books a thing of the past. In Iraq, book lovers are fighting back. They have launched a book festival offering thousands of free books to encourage the Arab nation to read more. The festival is called Iraq Reads. It's attracted big crowds. Iraqis stood shoulder to shoulder behind long tables covered in books and flipped through hundreds of titles to find the one catching their interest. Some others gather on next to the stands to read under a tree, chat about their newest books, or listen to extracts of literature read aloud through a loudspeaker. One of the organizers says they aim to revive the culture of reading books, reading paper books.
It's a crisis all over the world, not only in Iraq. There is a crisis in terms of reading paper books. One of the goals for our festival is to revive the reading of paper books so that the electronic book does not become an alternative of the paper book.
As part of the festival, 70,000 books have been distributed for free across the country so far. The books covering a wide range of topics were donated by partner libraries. The festival is held in 7 provinces in the Arab country.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has been re-elected as GOP Senate leader, managing to stave off a challenge from fellow Republican Senator Rick Scott of Florida. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website of Forbes.com has also covered this story. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, will serve another 2 years as a top Senate Republican after staving off a challenge from Senator Rick Scott, a fellow Republican from Florida, as GOP leaders face blowback for the party underperforming in the midterm elections. Senator Mitch McConnell beat Rick Scott by a vote of 37 to 10, with one senator voting present. GOP lawmakers told reporters following a closed-door meeting that lasted more than 3 hours. The election was carried out via secret ballot, leaving it unclear how all the senators voted. Rick Scott, who chairs the National Republican Senatorial Committee and is widely considered one of the most hard-right senators in Congress, was the first Republican to challenge Mitch McConnell since he became Republican Senate leader in 2007. Rick Scott announced his leadership bid on Tuesday, 15th of November, saying Republicans needed bold change after a poor midterm election showing, though Mitch McConnell said he was confident he had enough votes to be re-elected. Republican leaders are reeling after the party failed to win back control of the U.S. Senate in last week's midterm elections, even as it appears the GOP is on pace to win the House of Representatives by a narrow margin, despite expectations of Republicans cruising in on a red wave to capture both chambers. Former President Donald Trump's stature in the Republican Party appears to have taken a big hit, as voters widely rejected midterm candidates in competitive races who embraced Trump's false allegations of fraud in the 2020 presidential election. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, has also faced backlash. The GOP nominated McCarthy on Tuesday as the party's choice for the next Speaker of the House, but he only won in a 188-31 vote among Republicans, leaving him well short of the 218 votes he needs from the full House to win the speakership. Members of the hard-right House Freedom Caucus led the pushback, and they're expected to make demands in exchange for supporting Kevin McCarthy prior to the full House vote. Tensions have simmered between Rick Scott and Mitch McConnell for months, but reached a fever pitch after the midterm elections, with allies of Mitch McConnell blaming Rick Scott's National Republican Senatorial Committee, a fundraising platform of Senate Republicans, for the poor midterm election results. Mitch McConnell also notably panned a Scott proposal released earlier this year that would require low-income Americans to pay income tax and require Congress to reauthorize Social Security and Medicare every 5 years. NBC News has also covered the same story. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky was re-elected as Republican leader on Wednesday, defeating a challenge from Senator Rick Scott of Florida that reflects growing anxiety within the Republican Party after it underperformed in the midterm elections. A Mitch McConnell spokesman, David Popp, confirmed the secret ballot victory. Senator Mike Braun, a Republican from Indiana, told reporters that 37 Republicans voted for Mitch McConnell, while 10 supported Rick Scott, and one voted present. The vote came after the conference rejected a motion by Mitch McConnell's dissenters to delay the leadership election, which 16 Republicans voted for, according to two sources. The McConnell-Scott battle represents a larger clash over the direction and governing vision of the Republican Party, with the two men offering conflicting theories about why the GOP failed to win the Senate